I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. Last week, the Washington Post announced that it would refrain from making an endorsement in the 2024 presidential race. An endorsement by the Post for Kamala Harris was widely expected, but the last-minute reversal by owner Jeff Bezos has raised questions of anticipatory obedience by the rich and powerful to the demands of fascism and authoritarian reprisal. Bezos denied the accusation in an op-ed, but it is a hard sell. Bezos has owned the Washington Post since 2013. So why now? Some of the most informed analysis about the situation comes from Post insiders, including veteran reporters and editors. I caught up with former columnist and Post Metro editor Robert McCartney, who retired from the Post in 2021 after 39 years at the paper. McCartney and I have talked in the past about the decline of the Post's local coverage, and one of my big questions for him was whether the endorsement ban would extend to local races where the Post's approval has carried tremendous weight. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the Washington, D.C. rock and roll band Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersluis on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutro and Juniper.
Won't pick up my phone if it rings all night. Ask me anything, it's all right. I'll tell you I'm neutral. Oh, I'm really, really neutral. Yeah.
Robert McCartney, welcome back to I Hate Politics.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Washington Post decided not to endorse in the 2024 presidential race days before the November 5th elections. Was this entirely unexpected? Did you see it coming?
No, it was completely unexpected. The paper has been endorsing candidates since 1976. It's endorsed candidates in this election cycle. It endorsed Angela Alsobrooks for the Senate and Eugene Vindman for the House in Virginia. So it's, you know, endorsements and presidential endorsements have been routine by the paper's editorial page for decades. And I think there was no expectation that they might not endorse this time. It was a big surprise.
There was this editorial endorsement that was written on behalf of Kamala Harris that essentially got spiked.
And it's widely reported, including by the Post, that David Shipley, the editorial page editor, had written an endorsement of Kamala Harris for president, which was completely in line with everything the editorial page, as an editorial page, you know, as the editorial board has been saying about this election, about the relative merits of Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. You know, it was absolutely no surprise that they were planning to endorse Kamala Harris, and he had actually drafted an editorial. And then 11 days before the presidential election, It was spiked. Yeah, it was. They were ordered to not publish it. The ultimate decision was made by the owner, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, the second richest man in the world. But I think a major instigator of this was the publisher, Will Lewis, who I believe urged Bezos to basically adopt this new rule of not endorsing presidential candidates. We endorsed Dwight Eisenhower in 1952, and then we endorsed Jimmy Carter in 1976. And we've endorsed presidential candidates in every year since then, except in 1988. Always Democrats, by the way, after Eisenhower.
Will Lewis, the publisher, in his justification, writes that 1976, they chose to do it for expected reasons. It is unclear what those expected reasons are, he doesn't write.
The paper's reporting led directly to the only resignation by an American president in U.S. history, that of Richard Nixon. And so they had been, they were disgusted with Nixon's behavior. And I guess they didn't think that. And then Gerald Ford, who succeeded him, pardoned Nixon. And I think they just disapproved of the whole everything the Republicans stood for at that point.
So what has been the fallout from your perspective?
The most dramatic thing, of course, has been the loss of 250,000 people have canceled their subscriptions. That's about 10% of the subscription base. There's probably more to come. That's on top, and that's in a matter of days. That's on top of the loss of 500,000 subscriptions from 2020 to 2020 till the beginning of this year. So they lost half as many subscriptions in basically over a long weekend as they had in the previous 4 years. And the loss of subscriptions previously had been considered, disastrous. It led to the buyouts with an underlying threat of layoffs of about 100 people from the newsroom and 100 people from the business side, and a loss of $70 million a year, and really a financial crunch at the paper. We'll lose 250,000 because of an editorial decision, a botched editorial decision. It's one of the biggest, own goals in American journalistic history. So in addition to that, let's see, the 21 columnists have written a joint statement denouncing the decision. Three people have quit the editorial board. Two people have actually resigned entirely as columnists. Robert Kagan, who's a foreign affairs, rather conservative, actually, foreign affairs writer, and Michelle Norris, a very prominent former NPR correspondent who's been writing a column for us. They've both quit. David Hoffman, a two-time Pulitzer winner, former top editor of both the national and foreign sections, one of the most respected journalists associated with the paper, has resigned, was one of the ones who resigned from the editorial board. Let's see, it's been denounced by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. It's been denounced by the revered former executive editor, Marty Baron. And it has provoked condemnations on the Washington Post alumni listserv. Scores of people read it, probably hundreds, actually, of retired Post people such as myself. It's really raised questions, about the integrity and independence of the paper. The conspiracy theory is that Bezos did it because he didn't want to annoy Trump in case Trump wins, and then Trump would use his, powers of government to punish Bezos's multiple business interests. I kind of doubt that. I mean, that might have been in the back of, well, I don't know, actually. It's sort of hard to tell what Bezos is thinking. He wrote a statement that appeared in the paper defending his action after the fact, which was, I thought, was very lame and disingenuous.
Why did you think it was lame and disingenuous?
Well, so he's basically saying, you know, the American people don't trust the news media. He's basically covering his butt. He said that the reason people don't trust the news media is because they see it, they think it's biased, and that the endorsements create an impression of bias. He's taking a principled position. Okay, he's owned the paper since 2013. It's been making presidential endorsements and endorsements in governor's races, senatorial races, congressional races, county council and DC council races for that entire time since 2013. It endorsed people in the current election cycle. That happened just a few weeks ago. And now in the presidential race, which arguably one of the most consequential presidential races in our lifetimes, he suddenly has this epiphany where he decides that he's not, that it's unfair to endorse people, it only comes after the editorial page has drafted an endorsement. You know, 250,000 people who did trust the news product and who were paying good money, they all stopped doing it, stopped paying, canceled their subscriptions because they don't trust what he did. They trusted the Post until he did this. He owns a news media product, so he's basically trashing his own product. It's like through the looking glass for him. What I think happened, and this is my speculation, Will Lewis, the publisher, picked by Bezos, conservative, a pal of the populist right-wing, former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, a veteran of many, many years in the Murdoch right-wing, you know, journalistic empire. That's where he came from, Murdoch, both in Britain and in the United and at the Wall Street Journal. I think he did not want to endorse Kamala Harris.
How about the idea that Bezos picked Lewis because he wanted to recenter the paper?
We haven't seen it moving to the right. And I would have heard that if the reporters or editors felt that way. In 2016, when Hillary ran against Trump, the then publisher, also a Republican, Fred Ryan, he, according to Marty Baron, the former editor of the executive editor of the Washington Post, Marty Baron wrote in his book that Fred Ryan urged no endorsement in 2016. And Bezos said, why wouldn't we endorse? And so they endorsed Hillary and Joe Biden in 2020. But now suddenly he thinks differently. Now it's possible that he's concluded that in the, you know, with the business and commercial troubles at the Washington Post, that the way to turn things around in the long run is to sort of position the paper more in the center, more in the political center, and try to win over sort of more moderate and conservative readers. In the current national political climate, that would appear to be a long shot.
What is the impact of what some people are calling anticipatory obedience?
People are very concerned in the newsroom about the perception that Bezos's decision signifies some kind of kowtowing and obedience to Trump. And in fact, Post reported just in the last 24 hours that some sources are, you know, not, don't want to talk to Post reporters because they think Bezos has put his thumb on the scale in favor of Trump. The biggest concern, I think, in the Post newsroom among the reporters, the people who aren't on the opinion side, is all these canceled subscriptions. And they're asking people, don't cancel your subscriptions, you know, that's just going to lead to more shrinkage of the revenue and ultimately a shrinkage of the newsroom, fewer resources for news coverage.
That's the position of The Atlantic, who have said that don't cancel the Washington Post subscription, instead cancel your Prime subscription.
Right. I think that's a way to navigate the narrow channel.
So Bezos talks about trust. He talks about an echo chamber. He talks about elitism. And he talks about a fear of losing to podcasts. Do you think that's real?
I think in the current environment, it's real. I'm not going to try to outthink Jeff Bezos when it comes to predicting future marketing.
I get the motivation to say that. But clearly, on this one thing, withdrawing endorsements at the last minute, changing policy few days ahead of the election. He has clearly miscalculated. So he is not that all-knowing.
That's true. This is the worst business decision and journalistic decision, both, that he has made in 11 years as owner of the Washington Post.
Look at what he has done. So in your last 10 years, and of which, you overlapped with Bezos's ownership, he has cut local coverage. He has cut so much that made the Post a Washington paper. And then to say, well, we have lost trust. You remove the investment, you don't cover, and then obviously you're going to lose trust.
The cutbacks in local coverage have certainly cost trust and readership, I would say, in the Washington area. But that's not inconsistent with Bezos's overall strategy. He changed the newspaper's mission when he bought the paper, and he said that openly. Under the Graham family that owned the paper for decades, the mission of the paper, the publicly declared mission of the paper, was to serve the local audience. And it just so happened to also have this marvelous national and international reputation. Well, Bezos, he wasn't interested in the local audience. He wants, he wants to rule the world. He wants to have the most successful English language news product globally. The cutbacks, the dramatic shrinkage in local coverage, which began, by the way, before Bezos took over. From after the 2008 recession, there was a extraordinary shrinkage of the local news staff. And then when Bezos came in initially, he didn't shrink the local staff initially. He just kept it the same while he grew other parts of the paper. So it shrank as a percentage of the resources committed to overall news coverage. But now they actually have shrunk the news, the local coverage, by quite a bit. There's no local business coverage. The Metro staff has been reduced in size. That has hurt trust and confidence and interest in the paper in the Washington area. But he doesn't care about that. He cares about the total readership of the paper, and the way to maximize that is to go after the national and international.
The brouhaha is really about the presidential elections and endorsement in the presidential elections. But if you read Bezos carefully, the logic of his argument applies up and down. It applies in local coverage. It applies in local endorsements, as state endorsements, Washington, D.C., the Maryland suburbs, the Virginia suburbs. The Post has been a central part of the politics of the entire region.
If you read what he wrote about endorsements, this is an extraordinary contradiction. He thinks that presidential endorsements create the appearance of bias. Why only presidential endorsements? By the logic of what he wrote, and I bet he didn't even mean to do this, he's going to have to stop. Well, I don't want him to stop endorsements, right? I want him to keep endorsing. But the logic of what he wrote would, it seems to me, imply that in the long term, they're going to have to stop endorsements altogether. That would be an enormous change for the local market. The Washington Post endorsement has been a significant factor in politics in this region since I was a kid, growing up in Chevy Chase in Bethesda, Maryland. I was told one time by a longtime Montgomery County politician that one of the main factors that determine who won in a primary or even in a general election was the Washington Post endorsement. Getting the Washington Post endorsement was a significant factor for a lot of politicians here in a lot of races. And to its credit, under the Graham family, the Washington Post editorial page put a lot of resources, a lot of effort into figuring out whom to endorse in these local races, including, really, small races for very small jurisdictions.
Right.
They would interview all the candidates. They would do in-depth interviews. You know, they would study the records. There was a lot of work put into those endorsements, and those endorsements, as a result of that quality work, carried a lot of weight. So if they actually stop doing endorsements altogether in local, state and local races, which, as I say, seems inevitable given the logic of his own argument, that's going to create a big hole where there wasn't one before in the local political climate. Now, maybe he'll find some, you know, rationalization for why local endorsements are okay, but presidential endorsements aren't. You know, who knows? I mean, I don't think he knew a damn thing about local endorsements. I bet he didn't even know that the Post had endorsed Angela Alsobrooks for Senate. I mean, that's just not on his radar screen. I'm talking about Bezos.
Right.
But it's going to be on his radar screen really soon, because the next election, 2 years from now, next year, actually, in Virginia, there's going to be a race for governor. And those primaries, you know, the endorsements in the primaries made a significant difference in terms of who got nominated. So this is going to come up in a year, less than a year, in the Virginia race.
Right. So, you know, a politician like Mark Elrich, who's the county executive in Montgomery County right now, you know, he has made a long time criticism of the Post, which has not endorsed him repeatedly.
No, the Post doesn't like Elrich.
So from his perspective, if you think about him, so this has been an obstacle for people on the left to win elections. Does that change the dynamics of those elections in the primary, right? If you don't have the moderation provided by the Washington Post endorsement in these local races, do the primaries then move further to the left? And as a consequence, there's more, you know, right-wing activity, more right-wing participation in politics. You know, local politics will become as polarized as national politics.
I think it's impossible to know that. I mean, that it's a very interesting question. I mean, Elrich, the Post doesn't like Elrich because he's seen as too anti-business. But most, you know, a heck of a lot of, I mean, Republicans, local Republicans would complain that the Post's, you know, thumb on the scale is very much in the favor of the Democrats and in favor of the left. I mean, they endorsed also Brooks over Hogan. It was, you know, it was a big deal when they endorsed Hogan, the Republican, for governor when he ran for re-election. Right. In the district, the endorsements, I mean, I hate to put it in racial terms, but I think it is true, objectively true, that the endorsements have a lot more impact with the white community in the district than with the African-American. The African-American community has complained for years that the Post endorsements were too oriented towards, you know, white interests, you know, upper middle class professional interests.
That's right.
You know, they never liked Marion Barry, although they did endorse Barry when he first ran. You know, the famous, interesting. They certainly turned against him later. And a lot of times people have been endorsed by the Post and lost in district elections, partly, especially in. If the African-American vote was significant.
So we don't have an authoritative voice in news that can tell America's story. The Washington Post was the authoritative voice in the Washington story. By removing that, what you're doing is allowing the extreme political entrepreneurs to come in, occupy positions that they had not in the past. So the Post, in effect, had a moderating impact on politics.
Yeah, I think that's plausible. I think we're not going to know. Another thing is the endorsements alone, you know, are not the most, you know, are only a fraction of what the Post does. I mean, then there's the news coverage, and then there's also the columnists. I mean, you got Colby King, now you got Mark Fisher writing about local affairs. I mean, I think they'll play a role. You've got Petula Dvorak.
Sure. Okay, let me ask maybe a broader question. To what extent do you think endorsements are separate from opinion writing? Because if you can make the case that endorsements are a problem or a bias, deplete trust, then why not other opinions?
That pokes a huge hole in Bezos's and Lewis's whole argument. What they would say is, if the editorial page issues an endorsement or the editorial page writes an editorial, then it's seen as the paper as a whole taking a position rather than just one individual columnist taking a position.
But the paper writes an editorial every day.
I know. This is the thing. I mean, if you read the editorials that we've had just since the non-endorsement, you know, they've been very critical of Trump and much more supportive of Kamala. So it's like it's no secret, you know, which way the editorial page leans. But of course, everybody knows that they were going to endorse Kamala anyway. I mean, they never endorsed a Republican like since Dwight Eisenhower in 1952. The paper was bought by Eugene Meyer at bankruptcy auction in the 1930s because he wanted to have editorials in support of the New Deal, in support of Franklin Roosevelt. You know, the ownership of the paper going back almost, 90 years is what was to be a Democratic voice, Democratic partisan Democratic voice, as far as the editorial page goes, in the nation's capital, because the dominant paper then was the Star, which was Republican.
One of the things that Bezos says in his note, in his own op-ed, that an endorsement from a paper does not tip the scales. So why then is this furor?
A lot of it has to do with the timing. If the paper had come out in January and said, oh, by the way, we're not going to be endorsing for president this year, people would have been mad, but they're not nearly as mad as they are now in this highly charged partisan environment where everybody's, you know, on the edge of their seats, very much compounded by the perception, you know, which started from the very beginning. It was the product of, as you said, of anticipatory obedience, that he was basically bowing down to Trump. And again, we need to make clear, when Trump was president, he put a lot of pressure on Bezos, and Bezos didn't yield at all. Bezos has been a pretty exemplary owner of the Washington Post, frankly. I mean, overall, he's put a lot of money into it. He has not interfered in the news product, to my knowledge. There have been a lot of articles written by the news side that have been very critical of Bezos. They've exposed, you know, bad things about Amazon.
Except local reporting.
Well, yeah. If you care about local coverage, then he's been bad for the Post. But I think that started even under the Graham family, who were huge supporters. And also, I mean, find me a newspaper in the country with better local coverage than the Post. I mean, it's what's happened across the country. The New York Times doesn't cover the New York area.
Interestingly, New York Times gave up local endorsements, yeah, but they continue doing presidential ones. So it's like a different take.
It's the reverse, yeah. Yeah, yeah, but we're going to see. I'll be very... If they continue doing local endorsements after what Bezos wrote, I mean, it's, you know, there's no explaining it on the logic. They continue doing local endorsements. You're going to have to assume that he's okay with the perception of bias in the local races, but not in the national.
That's correct.
What does that mean?
So how does Washington Post rebuild its reputation at this time?
Oh, by not doing any more, you know, own goals, by continuing to do great investigations, great news coverage. But this is going to, people are going to remember this. That's the thing. It's like a year from now, I'm sure a year from now, I'll be hearing, you know, oh, I canceled my subscription to the Post. I'll never go back after they spiked the endorsement of Harris.
But will they go back is the question.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I think that's a very good question. And that will depend a lot on whether or not the Post, they miss it, whether they miss the Post's coverage or they, I mean, I've had a lot of people tell me, nope, I'm just going to read the New York Times now. Or I'm going to read The Guardian, you know, which is left-leaning publication. Yeah, my own sister canceled her subscription.
Well, that is something. Robert McCartney, thank you for taking the time. I hope the Post rebuilds.
Oh, it's still there. Yeah, it's just got some cleaning up to do.
What lessons should we draw from my conversation with former Washington Post columnist and Metro editor Robert McCartney? In 1976, the year Washington Post began its era of presidential endorsements, the circumstances, according to publisher Will Lewis, were understandable. He doesn't specify, but post-Watergate, Ford's pardon of Nixon, the stock of the Republican Party was down. But what about now in 2024? Is an endorsement of Kamala Harris and a disavowal of the country's most ardently fascist presidential candidate since Charles Lindbergh not good reason? We might say that the stakes are even higher today. Trump has promised retribution against political opponents, the removal of nonpartisan bureaucrats, the forcible removal of 12 million residents, has publicly hoped for a day of violence in the streets, used disaster relief for political purposes, has been found guilty of criminal activity, allowed himself and his relatives to enrich themselves using high office. By comparison, Gerald Ford was a saint. Questions and commentary about the role of the press, objectivity of the press, and related matters is not just valid but necessary and continuing. But let's not forget, Eugene Meyer bought the Washington Post in bankruptcy sale in the 1930s primarily to be able to run editorials in support of President Roosevelt and the New Deal. Many newspapers have partisan roots and partisan shoots and partisan leaves. One way for newspaper owners to honor their politics and to accord themselves and their papers credibility has been to separate news and editorial pages, including staffing them with different people. This wall has stood up at times and crumbled at others. Newspaper owners have also stood above the fray by making the case that they did, in fact, stand above the fray, that their opinions, editorials, and endorsements were made for the greater good of society, country, or even the world. Claiming that right to make judgments in the name of greater good, combined with an independent newsroom, and finding the financial resources not to be dependent on government, have been the three pillars of media independence. Part of this independence is to be able to make the choice to make political endorsements. Apparently, this is not a choice anymore. In Jeff Bezos's case, we might never know whether anticipatory obedience or incompetence of an otherwise extraordinarily successful person was the reason behind the ending of endorsements. It doesn't really matter, because that's what people will believe no matter what he has to say. Even the mostly Trump supporters who have come out in support of his decision will bring it up the next time the Post is critical of their preferences. But most importantly, Trump himself has noted that he can use implicit threats and intimidation to secure better coverage or at least stop favorable commentary of his opponent. I will point out that Bezos is not afraid of upsetting Kamala Harris, only Trump. Whether the Post will recover from this is an open question, to me at least. On the plus side, there isn't another Deep Pockets starting a competing newspaper in the DC region. It is likely that the Post will retain its advertising. Any losses in subscriptions will likely be made up as people's memories of this incident fades. But it should also be clear to everyone that we are not going back to the Post's local coverage, for example. Bezos says that the threat to traditional newspapers comes from podcasts and other new media. But he has the causal direction wrong. New media has not ousted newspapers in some kind of even field competition. They have filled the gap left by newspapers, which have demonstrated a penchant for self goals. This week has been a loss for democracy, independence, and decency. Maybe next week we'll make a comeback. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. rock and roll band, Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloot on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutral and Juniper. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. Go vote! Come down in